Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
15 odd years ago, I went to the bank manager and said, look, you know, we are in this position. Hospital's very supportive, but 10 is going to become 20. And if we do this, it's not going to work long time. So I need to buy a warehouse to put these freezers. So I had identified a warehouse where I think we could have put these freezers. So he said, how much is it? I said, it's £1 million. And he said, how much money do you need? I said, I need £1 million.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. The show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. If you are listening to this and you are of South Asian descent, this episode might be a bit of an uncomfortable listen, because what we're chatting about today is why, despite the advances in medicine, people of South Asian origin are twice as likely to suffer from cardiovascular disease, three times as likely to have diabetes, as well as many other related diseases that you can think of, including cancer and dementia. And I know the title of this pod is Why South Asians Are at Worst Risk, but the honest answer is we still don't have a good idea. And this is why, if you are between the ages of 18 and 85 and of South Asian heritage, look at the description in the podcast show notes on your pod player right now. There is a link right at the top of this episode for the Biobank study at sabiobank.org. That's sabiobank.org. Click on the link, stop listening to this pod for about 5 minutes, and book an appointment immediately. You'll get a free full health assessment, including bloods, lipid assessment, body composition, retinal photography, plus a full breakdown on your risks and advice on where you need to get your numbers. Your data is completely anonymized, and you'll be contributing to a major worldwide resource for medical researchers for decades to come, who can finally answer these important questions that explain the disparity in health between South Asians and others. Now, I've done a bunch of these well-being assessments in the past myself, because as someone who is interested in nutritional medicine, preventative health, and someone from South Asian descent, I know my risk is much higher than my colleagues, and my risk is further multiplied by the fact that I have had cardiac arrhythmia. Thankfully, that has resolved, but my history alone puts me at further risk, which is why I need to be really hot on prevention. And trust me, these assessments cost hundreds of pounds each, if not thousands, but the trial will give you the assessment absolutely free, and you'll be contributing to the most ambitious research study of a generation, which could generate personalized medicine recommendations for a quarter of the world's population, who are largely underrepresented in current research. We've talked about underrepresentation in research in previous podcast episodes as well. My guest today is Professor Jaspal Kuna, who is leading the South Asia Biobank study. Professor Kuna is one of the leading cardiologists in the country with over 30 years' experience in the treatment of general cardiovascular disorders. He is a consultant at Imperial College Healthcare Trust and an active researcher who has pioneered some major discoveries and published numerous times in journals such as Nature, including research revealing novel genetic variants that underlie coronary heart disease, type 2 diabetes, obesity, and other highly prevalent disorders. I think this podcast is going to be a real inspiration, particularly for young medics out there or people just thinking about medicine, because Prof shares his stories of upbringing in Nairobi and his move to Kent in England, plus his journey to medicine, through medicine, his thoughts on medical education today, when he first learnt of the disparity between health in certain populations, as well as how he navigated the system. I really hope by the end of the podcast, you realise the graft it has taken to get here. There are some absolutely amazing stories, including about how he sold the vision for this study and others preceding it through sheer determination, asking a bank manager for £1 million when he had no money himself, and having to store research freezers in hospital corridors. All become clear when you listen to the pod. And remember, they're looking to recruit over 200,000 people of South Asian origin for this study, and I've already contributed. And if you're of South Asian background, please just go check it out, sabiobank.org. It was a pleasure to sit down with him for about an hour and a half. I honestly could have chatted for longer, but for now, please do enjoy my conversation with Professor Jaspal Singh Kuna. I want to start by talking a bit about your career. Okay, so most people will know you as one of the most eminent cardiologists in the country. You've been published in multiple journals. You know, you've got incredible academic colleagues, and you've had papers in Nature. And you know, everyone sees that side of things. That's the stuff that people can find online. What we can't find out about is a bit about you as a person, your clinical career. So tell us. First of all, where did you grow up?
So I was born in Nairobi in Kenya. We arrived at the time of the big rush in the 1960s. I was around 10 at the time. So we found ourselves in Gillingham in Kent. And that's where I grew up. I went to school in Gillingham in Kent. So I went to Gillingham, ultimately Gillingham Grammar School, which was a great, great school to be in. And having done my O-levels, A-levels and so on, then I progressed on to medicine at St. Thomas's.
Amazing, amazing. I did not know that you grew up in Nairobi. And so when you came over here, it must have been a very different environment. I mean, how did you fit in? I mean, you're clearly Sikh, you have a turban. What was that an easy transition for you, or...?
It wasn't easy in those days. So Gillingham had a population of about 100,000 people. There were, I think, no more than 5 Asian families. We were the only turban Sikhs, my brother and I, in our school. So, you know, we confronted a mixture of curiosity, intrigue, periodic bullying, as one might expect. But actually, on the whole, I think, you know, it was incredible how well we were embraced at all walks of life. You know, if you imagine that scenario in the 1960s and everything that went on at that time, we felt so incredibly lucky to be in an environment where we were, you know, nurtured, our appearance was appreciated. You know, our hard work in various areas was appreciated. Our sporting prowess was appreciated. So I played a lot of hockey. So that gave me a bit of an edge at school and allowed that level of integration, actually, with my friends.
Yeah, I find... sport is a fantastic connector, as well as food and other attributes. But sport, I find, is something that really rallies people together across different cultures. And I think if you can have a shared interest in something like that, it definitely breaks down barriers.
I think definitely, and more so at school. Academia at schools is not necessarily the priority, and certainly wasn't the priority in those days. And the schools like to have good teams. If you went around with your friends, that was one area where you could actually find a great deal of commonality. And if you had something to contribute, then that was a positive thing, positive to develop those friendships.
Mm, yeah. And were your parents in medicine as well? Was that not at all.
I think my father went out to Kenya from India in his teens. He may even have been 16 or 17. He pretended to be 21. He joined the British Army in Kenya.
Oh, wow.
And soon after the war, he then joined the East African Railways. So he actually worked in the East African Railways. And
oh, wow.
My mother, she was a housewife in Kenya. So when we came across her in the 1960s, he went and worked in the local factory for 15 years while he was here. And my mother became a seamstress. That's what she did at home in Nairobi. So she joined a women's factory as a seamstress. And they, our parents, put an incredible amount of effort into educating us, looking after us. So medicine is this generation. My mother comes from a family of people in the armed forces. My father comes from a family of farmers. They found themselves doing kind of factory work while they were here. And it just so happens that in this generation, I obviously went to medicine at St. Thomas's. I have two brothers. They went to university college to do dentistry. And my sister went into teaching biology. And then, as we look at the next generation coming on, God knows, I think we've got about 13, 14 doctors and 12, 13 dentists in the next generation. The family is just mushroomed into a kind of medical family. From my father's generation, which was nothing to do with medicine.
Wow. Single-handedly, the family is populating all the staff needed in the NHS.
I think you see the challenges of the NHS from different dimensions. I see it from my angle. My wife is a GP. So I see it from the GP angle, and the kids are training. And so I see it from the junior doctor's angle, from a window of a family, as opposed to multiple, junior colleagues, which I've had the pleasure of working with over many years. So it gives you a different perspective and different pressures in the NHS and family life.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, it seems like everyone, including your siblings, were interested in science at a very early age. Where do you think that fascination for science came from, if it wasn't from your parents?
I think because personally, I was just so bad at arts, and so you gravitated to something that you could do. And initially, it was maths and science. And you start working at things where you're good at, and then took on science subjects at school. That's how it happened.
Amazing. So walk us through your career a bit, because you went to St. Thomas's. What was it like after you graduated, and how did you decide to follow your career, which eventually led you to both academia but also with the specialty in cardiology?
So St. Thomas's, when I joined St. Thomas's, again, like Gillingham in Kent, I was one of two, three Asians in St. Thomas's. Mm. St. Thomas's was a small medical school. We had 60 graduates in our year, which is a far cry from what you see of hundreds of graduates in each year at medical school. So it was very, very kind of a cozy environment. Everyone knew everyone. Working your way through a medical degree. And the incredible thing about training in those days was mentorship. We had incredible physicians and surgeons at St. Thomas's in a way that even now, looking back, I find it difficult to find those kind of role models in this day and age to what we had in those days. That mentorship was crucial. You saw people, delivering at a very high level, and that was inspirational. So we had, very good cardiac physicians, cardiologists who were innovating at the time, and that sort of drew me to a specialty in my undergraduate year. And I did a house job at St. Thomas's. My first house job was in cardiac surgery, actually. Working with two cardiac surgeons and a chap called Mark Bainbridge and Bryn Williams. And Mark was an incredible teacher in addition to a good surgeon. And, these guys used to do 3 or 4 cases in a day and bypass operations in a day. Now, I have to tell you today, if a surgeon does 4 in a week, he's considered to be a busy surgeon. Okay, so that's 2021. In those days, he and Bryn Williams used to do 4 cases a day. Wow. And there was the two of them, there was a senior registrar, and myself as a houseman. So I was, as a houseman, had to look after all the patients in the ward because they were so busy operating. And when I'd done the wards, I was called into theater. And my job was actually to come and take the vein out, to harvest the vein, so that I could hand over the vein for the bypass, and then they would get on and do the bypass, and I would end up closing the leg. And, in those days, I was the first one to start, and I was the last one to finish, and that's how it went. So I enjoyed that job. I enjoyed that job because it gave me an insight into cardiovascular medicine, and then I joined the ITU at St. Thomas's, which was also a very, very high-powered unit, Mead Ward it was called, and we had an incredible ITU kind of a position. These guys didn't write many papers, but they used to write monographs and books. And monographs and books were actually world famous because of it had distilled down their experience in terms of managing patients at a very high level. So that's where I kind of was drawn into cardiovascular medicine. And I felt that if I had the opportunity, that's what I'd like to be able to do. And of course, in those days, you didn't have the kind of the structured environment that we see nowadays in training. There were no QR codes. You couldn't punch in a QR code and go off and do your training program and emerge 6 years later as a gastroenterologist or something. So you had to do the groundwork yourself. So you went into the BMJ adverts and you applied to work in centers which you felt were going to be good for you. And more importantly, actually, you hunted down people in the country who you thought you would like to be able to work through and would give you that mentorship and the inspiration to continue. So having done my house job at St. Thomas, I went to Worthing to do my second house job in Worthing with another incredibly good physician, David McBrien. And then I came back to Guy's. I did some jobs at Guy's, worked on the renal unit at Guy's, again, with 3 incredible renal physicians. And then I went off to Blackpool to do a job in Blackpool. And that was very interesting because it wasn't the done thing. If you wanted to have a career in medicine, you stuck to the top end centers. And there was this kind of golden circuit in those.
Yeah.
The golden circuit was a Mead job at St. Thomas's, the renal unit at Guy's, Queen Square for neurology, mm-hmm. and you did a job at Hammersmith, and then you could go on your happy career. That was the golden routine in those days. That was the kind of training program, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. So what led you to Blackpool? Because that sticks out quite a bit.
Yeah, it surprised my colleagues. Actually, at some level, it was an opportunity because I felt I wanted to see what happened in the district. And this then shaped actually also what I went on to do later. It was good to be in the centres, but, you know, to be out where you could do some real medicine and do more practically. That's what led me to Blackpool, and that was where two consultants and two SHOs. You can just imagine it's now a regional centre with God knows 15, 20 cardiologists and scores of trainees. In those days, there were just two, and that's you looked after the population as best you could. And again, the consultants used to be quite busy in doing angiograms and catheters and. You know, as the two SHOs, you had to pick up all the other stuff. So I spent 9 months learning a lot of cardiology and doing a fair number of angiograms as an SHO, putting about 70-odd pacemakers as an SHO. So when I came back, having done Blackpool after 9 months, I remember attending a job at Hammersmith, and there was incredulity. How, you know, you've done 70 pacemakers, that's not possible. Because our registrar doesn't do 70 pacemakers here in a year. So, you know, the world was different to what it was out in the sticks, to what it was in the centers. And even then, it wasn't appreciated just like now. Easy to be working in centers in your own little narrow area and be oblivious to what's happening out in the districts. So those are the kind of, you know, it shaped my views that if I ever did become a consultant, that I would like to maintain a very strong hold in a population who I could look after rather than be stuck in a center doing fairly narrow things.
Yeah. Well, that really resonates with me quite a bit, because I remember when I qualified in 2009, I made the decision quite contrary to what a lot of other Imperial medical students were doing at the time, which is staying in Northwest Thames or somewhere around London. I actually went out and I went to Essex to go work in a DGH. And that's kind of where I found my love of medicine again, I think, because you were put in the deep end. I mean, nowhere near to your experiences 30 years ago. But that experience there, and also working in a rural environment in a GP practice in Truro down in Cornwall, that gave me a real like feel for that experience. I didn't think I was going to ask you this today, but I wonder, considering you know you have so many family members who work in the NHS at varying degrees of stage of training, do you think there are pros and cons with how we now train medics today? Considering, you know, your experience of hunting down the best in class and, you know, working towards a goal that you have to essentially build yourself rather than having a very structured training regime.
There were good things about finding your way, finding the people you wanted to work with, having the opportunity of working with the best people. It didn't always work because you didn't always get the jobs you wanted. And you moved around at leisure, you know, 6 monthly, 1 yearly, depending on when the jobs came up. But it did give you that edge, which you don't get now. I mean, I lament at the training programs these days. The good thing, I guess, is that people go in and come out with STs and become consultants. So there's some degree of security, but it's been done at a cost. You know, the training program now involves you filling in your details online. You get assigned to go to a particular area and work in particular hospitals, and that's no choice of your own. And you get to work with people who you may not want to work with, and you may not enjoy the jobs that you're doing. But you have to go through this kind of sausage machine and come out, you know, rather grey at the end. And I really feel for some, you know, really bright people within this sausage machine who have a potential to innovate, who have a potential to contribute, and are dumbed down by this process where they do not get that leverage to be able to train with the people that they want to, explore things whilst they're training, go slightly off-piste if they have an idea, they want to do a research project. They can't do it because, you know, their day is structured. In my days, if you had a research project, you know, you talked to your consultant, you sat around on the coffee table, and you got on and you did it. And, you know, that happened even actually when I started at Hammersmith in 1990. You know, we had three registrars. And Hammersmith was one of those places in those days which had, you know, worldwide reputation. The Royal Postgraduate Medical School, Hammersmith Hospital, was the place to be in the world. And we had three registrars, and the registrars came to work with us every year. They were expected to do clinical medicine because that was part of their training. They were also expected and did research, and they all produced high-level research by the time they left after just 1 year. And many of these guys went off to become consultants elsewhere. Now, that you see, doesn't happen these days. It just doesn't happen. You know, there's a timeliness about research. There's a timeliness about ideas. And if you do not nurture the idea that you might have waking up, having a cup of coffee, seeing a patient, that timeliness is gone. And that, you know, the wind out of your sail has gone. And that is what this current training program has lost. And I think the people who are in charge of these programs perhaps do not see.
On the subject of research, let's talk about your experience in academia. It sounds as if that you had the space to go and explore ideas throughout your training when you saw fit. When was your sort of first experience in that element of medicine, and what were the initial ideas that piqued your interest that's led to you now with this huge research project that we're going to talk about a bit later?
So I went, having done my registrar job, I was really lucky, actually. It was a lucky break. Those were lucky breaks in those days. So I'm here because of the lucky breaks in my career, as are many people in my generation. So I had done my year's registrar job, got my membership, and it was a done thing to go and do research. And I was looking around where I could possibly do that. And the chap I was working with at the time, David Thomas, who's a neurologist, said, look, I think you really need to go and speak to Stan Peart, Chris Mathias at St. Mary's. They're doing good work, and I think you will enjoy working with them. So I had no idea about the medical unit at St. Mary's. It was led by Stanley Peart, who's probably one of the finest physicians of his generation. Incredible clinician, incredible researcher, and ran the Wellcome Trust. And so I went and worked with him and the chap called Chris Mathias, who was working in autonomic function. Roger Bannister, who was working on autonomic function at Queen Square, but was also at St. Mary's. and Peter Sever, who was actually, who's still working with us now, incredible clinician and clinical trialist. So I had the opportunity of actually working closely with these very, very accomplished people. And my initial work was with no ideas of my own. I mean, you had no ideas. You just joined a unit and you see what they were doing. And they said, well, I think you should try to look at this. So my initial work was actually on the control of the circulation by the nervous system. So I was working on the autonomic nervous system. I was working on how hypertension was, renal hypertension was not driven just by renal artery stenosis, but was driven by the brain. I worked on paraplegic patients. I worked on tetraplegic patients. I worked on patients with brachial plexus injury because these were natural accidents which had led to injuries where you could explore the circulation and see how the circulation was controlled by the brain, by the spine, and in the periphery. So that was kind of my research degree. And then towards the end of that, I felt, oh, I think I would enjoy that for the rest of my career, but I had to grow up like everybody else. I had to finish my research right up and go on and do other things. So I then worked with the cardiovascular unit at St. Mary's with Rodney Fole, learned to work in cardiovascular medicine, started my training program with him on cardiovascular medicine. He was a great patron, very good cardiologist. Again, he's still working with us, very, very sound, accomplished cardiologist. And so I did that, and then another break came up, and that was my job at Hammersmith.
I came across this quote from someone the other day, because just as you're talking about breaks there and luck, it seems that the harder you work, the luckier you get. Would you agree with that?
I think, I think, you know, if you work hard, that's what I always found. If you put the hours in, your work gets appreciated. You may not always be successful. You may not publish where you want to publish. You may not discover what you might want to discover. You may not see your name on neon lights. But if you just work hard and you have the right intent, then people at all walks of life appreciate that. And I think in that walk of appreciation, doors open up. People make it possible for you to walk through open doors. Yeah. And I think that's a very important thing, you know, in medicine in general, being honest, having that integrity and putting an incredible amount of hard work in for no expected gain, this is what our careers are about, actually, as physicians and surgeons in medicine. And that's how medicine has evolved over centuries. And that mindset, it's sometimes difficult to understand, in the modern day environment. I find kind of graduates moving out of medicine into other walks of life where they think that maybe they'd be better rewarded, both in terms of their success in personal achievements or, you know, financial rewards. But I think few careers really meet that deep satisfaction you get from medicine.
I agree. I want to frame our conversation now about the work, the huge project that you're doing at the moment. And just to sort of anchor the listener to frame our conversation, I want to give some insight into folks listening about cardiometabolic risk triggers, if you like, that might lead to someone having pathology. So obesity, particular central obesity, the ratio of fats, perhaps even lipoprotein abnormality. So that's how we transport different molecules, inflammation, raised CRP or other acute phase reactants, Blood pressure, which is a whole other topic in itself, and metabolic disturbances, so insulin resistance, or even how we might transport glucose in the body. What I guess we want to be talking about is the reasons why there is a predisposition to some, if not all, of those different factors, particularly amongst the South Asian population, with a heavier focus on the genetic predisposition that I gather you've had most experience in. Does that sound like a nice starting point for you?
Yeah, I think so. That takes me back to when I moved across from St. Mary's to kind of Hammersmith and the Ealings. My post, which I still occupy at the moment, was a joint position at the Royal Postgraduate Medical School, now Imperial College, and Ealing Hospital. And Ealing, as you know, is in West London, serving a population in West London, of which 30% are South Asians. So I sort of started my consultant job there with no cardiovascular kind of unit. That's what I came across. I came across patients who were young. I came across patients who had central obesity, had high blood pressure levels, had a lot of diabetes, patients who had high abnormal lipids, principally high triglycerides, low HDL levels, perhaps cholesterol not so high, and had incredible premature severe heart disease. So it became obvious to me that if I was going to stay in this position for long enough, that one of the things that I had to do was actually to reorientate myself, to be able to looking after these people clinically, and secondly, to be able to understand this disease. So in the 1990s, we started in earnest working on this area.
Was this a well-recognized phenomena back then in the 90s? Had we known about this disparity, or is this a relatively new recognition?
It was becoming known in 1990. So in 1990, Paul McKeague, Mike Marmot had published a paper in The Lancet, 1991, drawing attention to the fact that Asians had premature severe coronary disease, high rates of disease, and there was this emergence of this syndrome of insulin resistance. So they had drawn attention to it, and that was timely because I was in the thick of it. And so it was a very natural thing for me to pick this up and to develop this research program. I was the only cardiologist. I had no team on the one hand, so I had this very great challenge with myself, half a secretary, half a technician, to build a clinical service, which took me about 10 years to build.
Wow.
And that was actually building a clinical service from scratch. In those days, money was tight, really tight. And so much of the building of this unit was through gathering up funds from the communities, grants, going to government with a begging bowl, and just getting money for where you could, buying furniture, buying machines, hiring on staff, writing grants. And then parallel to that was actually starting a research program. Now, if clinical work was difficult to get off the ground because there were no resources and you just had to do everything yourself, you can just imagine that if you wanted to start a research program, that also had its challenges. Yeah. Firstly, it was a new area. Secondly, you had to structure it. So when I started, I had a registrar at the time, a chap called John Chambers, who again still works with me. And he and I sat down and said, well, look, this is a great thing to do. And what we needed to construct was a proper long-term study to be able to understand this kind of disease. Because, you know, even now, the existing studies of diseases among South Asians are really small scale, retrospective study designs. They look at a very narrow range of risk factors, and that doesn't allow you to understand the contribution of exposures, whether they're environmental or genetic, in a kind of proper way. So we put together a study at that time called the Lollipop Study. Okay, the Lollipop Study was named simply because between us we had nothing and couldn't even afford a lollipop at the time. So that's what it was. The lollipop had no money, but we had big ambitions. Uh-huh. And we had ideas to cultivate a long-term population study. And so we put together a framework. We got together with about 50-odd GPs locally, and we said, look, we are all in this together. You have your patients. We have a patient we see in the hospital. Let's just put a team together, and let's put together a long-term cohort. We were lucky. Because, you know, we were busy delivering a clinical service for their patients. They appreciated that. And they also saw the merit in putting together a study and being part of a team, which could perhaps look towards answering these questions. So when it got a bit serious after a couple of years, Lollipop became a bit of a joke because, you know, it wasn't a done thing to be doing a serious study with a rather odd acronym. So we had to go back and revisit this. So what could we call it? So we then called it the London Life Sciences Population Study. Okay, so that translates into the Lollipop Study. So Lollipop Study is now 32,000 people, which we put together. It is coming over to a 15-year follow-up. It is the world's largest prospective population study of South Asians who've been followed up for 15 years for disease outcomes, and in whom we have detailed phenotypic data, detailed biological data, stored samples for genetic analysis. So that was how it came together. And now, obviously, with the success that Lollipop Study has enjoyed over the years, it has become, you know, world famed because it is the only population, prospective population cohort with large biological data amongst Asians. And yeah, but that was how it started. Lollipop started with no resource, no money.
I just want to go back a second because I think it's easy for us today to take for granted just how difficult that must have been back in the day. You found a disparity with a population in different types of disease. You have to then engage entrepreneurial skills and go and sell this for research funding, you know, go and beg, borrow from the government. You also have to, I mean, you come up with the funky acronym, which is now all the fashion, like all the big studies have funky acronyms now, and so you're a first mover in that as well. And I think, you know, it's easy for us to not really appreciate just how much time this has taken to get to this level. We just look at the outcome rather than, you know, this is something that you started well over a few decades ago.
Yes, so it was it's a journey. It's a journey which has occupied decades. You know, everything from what you say, it's fine having an idea, fine having ambitions, but then to translate it into practice. So, you know, we walked around Ealing, Southall, we went to see the GPs, we sat with them, we sold them our vision. You know, the National Service Framework was coming into line 15 years ago. The government was telling GPs, well, you know, guys, here's a National Service Framework for cardiology. We expect you to do da-da-da, like cholesterol, blood pressure for every patient. And we'll give you £2,000, £2,500 to do that. So we persuaded our local GPs that you don't need to do that. We will do it together. So why don't you put your £2,500 into the melting pot? And we will also put money in from the hospital. Let's make it a bigger pot and let's put the whole population together and let's do it in a systematic manner. So, you know, that took, you know, a couple of years to get around the people and then put the study together. And then obviously you have to do the work and you have to recruit people, train people. You have to have the systems in place to be able to see large numbers of people. You then need to, get the resources together to collect samples, to store samples. And so Lollipop, when it started, obviously you collect the biological data, you collect samples. Samples have to be stored in minus 70 freezers. Minus 70, I haven't seen a minus 70 freezer ever in my life. So we ordered one because that's where the samples needed to be stored. And it came through the hospital and it needed to be plugged in. So there was no space. We plugged it in the corridor. And so a big hospital corridor, the minus 70 freezer in our department. It was fine. Then one became two became four. So we then made a small room to put six minus 70 freezers in. And then it got to 10. And, gradually the study expanded. When it did get to about 10 freezers, I got a visit from the chief executive at the time. Can you just explain to me what these freezers are doing and how is it helping patient care? And, we just need to discuss a few things, including risk of having these freezers in the corridors with patients walking around. So we had a visit by the fire safety team who basically decided in their wisdom that they needed to either put a very high-powered electrical supply to stop the hospital system going down in that area, part of the hospital, or had to move the freezers out. And around 15 odd years ago, I went to the bank manager and said, look, we are in this position. Hospital is very supportive, but 10 is going to become 20. And if we do this, it's not going to work long time. So I need to buy a warehouse to put these freezers. So I had identified a warehouse where I think we could have put these freezers. So he said, how much is it? I said, it's £1 million. And he said, how much money do you need? I said, I need £1 million. he said, how much money do you have? I said, I have no money. But I need £1 million to buy this freezer warehouse. So he looked at me with a degree of as if I was coming from a madhouse. But as we talked, he bought into the story. And by the time we finished, he said, I didn't need £1 million. I needed £1.2 million because there were the additional costs. And that we would be prepared in those days to give me £1.2 million. Because I had no money, he would give me a £1.2 million loan at 1% interest.
Oh, my word.
Okay, so I bought this warehouse in Hanger Lane at £1.2 million of 1% interest, which we have, which is now a biorepository, which is now filled with 70 minus 80 freezers and over 5 million samples.
Amazing.
We're still paying off some of the loan and still at 1%.
Yeah,
that's these are kind of your research takes you through these journeys. So you come across these hurdles. You have to find solutions. And nowadays we can go to grant giving bodies. We're really lucky to be supported by the Wellcome Trust. In those days, when you don't have a track record, you don't have public relations, all you have is a vision. you have very limited opportunities to actually put a framework together to create something which you think may be worthwhile downstream. And so, you know, I used to do private practice in those days and put 10, 15 years of my private practice money directly into the research to make it happen. And to make it happen, that's what it took in those days. So it needs a team. It needed our patients, local population to buy in. It needed the GPs to buy in. It needed our hospital management in those days to buy in. It needed Lloyds Bank manager to buy in. And, you know, that's how it came together.
That's amazing. Your ability to sell the vision, just sounds phenomenal. I mean, that is the true sort of art of salesmanship and entrepreneurship right there. So that's incredible.
I think people used to get, once you tell them why you're doing it and what purpose, I was lucky, really lucky to having, a huge amount of support from my consultant colleagues at Hammersmith, at Imperial, at Ealing, and who were understanding of the need for this to happen and were very supportive. And so it takes a big team. It takes a lot of support from colleagues.
Amazing. So given we understand the disparity, we can recognize it from your current lens, and your current experience of the research and all the data you've collected, what are the main reasons for the disparities that we see thus far? I know this is still an open question that we're trying to answer, but from your perspective, what are the main reasons that you can tell us about?
Yeah, okay. So, you'd like to think that after 30 years of putting this population together, we would have answers. And as we were discussing very briefly on the phone yesterday, I come across this after 30 years, still asking the same questions that I was asking 30 years ago. So what is the problem? The problem is that South Asians worldwide account for 1.8 billion people. Okay, it's around a quarter of the world's population. And obviously, it is the largest ethnic minority group in the UK. And there's no question that this population, this quarter of the world's population, is at particularly high risk of a number of diseases. And the data which has been gathered up in the US, from Europe, this country, the UK, has shown that the South Asian community has twofold increased risk of coronary artery disease and threefold increased risk of type 2 diabetes. Mm. Now, this excess of these diseases, excess risk, is not explained by traditional risk factors as we know them. It's not explained simply by smoking, by cholesterol, by blood pressure, by diet, by physical exercise. Even when you factor all these risk factors in and you adjust for them, you still have around 2% excess risk of coronary artery disease and 3-fold risk of diabetes in this population. So the reasons why there's the excess risk are not understood. And this gap of knowledge is probably the single most important obstacle in tackling this epidemic of cardiometabolic diseases and other emerging diseases in this population. So, we focused, of course, on coronary artery cardiovascular disease and diabetes. You've talked about obesity and hypertension. Obesity is a big problem to a point where the World Health Organization has had to adjust its criteria for obesity amongst Asians, both for BMI and for waist circumference. And then, of course, there are the emerging diseases, prevalence of Alzheimer's disease and cognitive decline, which, you know, is a relatively new disease, as we think. It's projected to increase by 100% in the UK by 2040, but in South Asians by 300%. And even now, South Asians who come in diagnosed with dementia tend to be diagnosed 4 years early and have lower scores when they're diagnosed. So that's one condition, which is an important condition to understand and answer. Then there are, you know, associated conditions like depression. You know, South Asians suffer from disproportionately from depression. Again, around a twofold excess based on all published evidence among South Asians compared to Europeans. And again, the determinants of depression in this population are not known. You swing the clock back on forwards to 2020, 2021, we have the emergence of long COVID. Mm-hmm. And it's abundantly clear that South Asians have a high risk of COVID. Similarly for long COVID. This is not explained by socioeconomic factors, by crowding alone, by Podibas index, or by composite baseline measures of health. So, you know, you've got this number of diseases, cardiometabolic diseases, you've got dementia, Alzheimer's disease, you've got major depressive disorders, you've got emerging diseases like long COVID. And this population is exposed at around 2 to 3-fold risk of these diseases and not explained by risk factors as we understand them. So there's got to be a move away from the traditional ways in which we kind of explore these diseases to try to understand this gap. Now, of course, you know, when we talk about traditional approaches, we also have to look at the kind of limitations that we have had in studies amongst Asians to date. And I was telling you that existing studies of South Asians have relied on small sample size. They've been retrospective. They've usually looked at a very narrow range of risk factors with very limited ability to account for the proportion of the risk. So you don't get accurate estimates of disease associations. And you need large sample size. You need longitudinal studies. You need representation of men and women. You need the population to be representative of South Asians in general. For instance, you know, UK Biobank is the country's hugely successful longitudinal study, you know, one of the best studies ever to come out of the UK. And it recruited Asians, 500,000 people recruited. It recruited within the 500,000 people, 8,000 Asians. So that was the number of South Asians who participated in the study. And within this kind of framework, you know, we had about 240 Bangladeshis. So you can't understand these big diseases with just 8,000 people, and where, you know, the representation of people from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh is disproportionate. You know, having said that, you know, 8,000 is still a fantastically good number, and it is yielding important contributions. Led us to propose to the Wellcome Trust that, look, there were 8,000 people. South Asians are not well represented in long-term longitudinal population studies. And what we needed to create was to build on the Lollipop program of 32,000 people and extend that population base to 100,000 people, say, in the UK, and 100,000 people in South Asia, who we can then follow up longitudinally to investigate the contribution of not just the genetic determinants, but also of the different exposures that Asians might have in this country to what they would have in South Asia. So we put together this application to the Wellcome Trust, and we were very fortunate. Got funded about 2.5 years ago. And so this then transforms from the lollipop study into the South Asia Biobank study. So South Asia Biobank is basically the kind of vision of creating around about 200,000 people, 100,000 in this country and 200,000 in South Asia.
It seems to me that, you know, you're not convinced entirely by the environmental argument, which obviously has some bearing on the disparity between South Asians and Caucasian counterparts with regards to their risk profiles for a suite of different diseases. Do you think it's pointing more towards genetic variation in terms of the grandeur of effect versus environment, or do you think it's a blend of both, considering we are, you know, talking about something where we have imperfect information about the reasons as to why?
So it's very important, Rupi. I think it has to be a blend of both. It's, as I said, these diseases amongst, excess of these diseases are not explained amongst Asians. Now, that is partly due to the fact that the environmental exposures have not been captured properly. No one's really looked properly in a longitudinal manner at the contribution of diet. There's no longitudinal study of diet and South Asians and these diseases, whether it's heart disease or diabetes. Similarly, there's no good data on physical activity and its contribution to these diseases and, of course, obesity among South Asians. And then when you sort of go on to other environmental exposures, you know, it's possible that they've been captured but not been captured accurately. So there may well be a very strong contribution of the environment. I think the case we're making is that, look, we just need to do these things properly and accurately and have a large sample size to assess their contribution. And then, of course, there is a genetic component as well. And that cannot be ignored because the makeup of South Asians in terms of genetics is different. And, you know, we did publish a paper in Nature three or four years ago, where we demonstrated that obesity in South Asians, which, you know, you could argue is driven by unhealthy eating and physical inactivity, is responsible for 200 differential methylation markers. So methylation at 200 loci is different in Asians compared to Europeans, and it's driven by obesity. And of those 200 methylation markers, five are responsible, we think, for 30% of diabetes in Asians. So you could trace yourself back and say, look, actually, deal with it at source, deal with it at diet, deal with it at environment. You can prevent obesity, and you may actually, at the other end, be able to reduce the burden of diabetes. So I think the answer to your question is it's very likely that there's going to be a blend of environmental and genomic exposures to this. And what we need, which is a brainchild of South Asia Biobank, is now to put together this 200,000 cohort. So, you know, your fantastic podcast viewers need to engage with us on South Asia Biobank and be part of research and contribute to this journey by coming and having a one-hour assessment of their health, for us to be able to capture some of their data, an opportunity to follow them up for years to come in terms of their health, and then to be able to understand, you know, which direction are these exposures and the genetic variation taking us. Now, you know, the brainchild of South Asia Biobank is actually that we are in a position now, if we get this cohort together, of actually following up longitudinally multiple diseases at the same time. So cardiovascular disease, diabetes, hypertension, obesity, dementia, major depressive disorders, long COVID. We can follow up the cohort for all these diseases. And then to be able to take a step back and say, okay, we are collecting good data in terms of the phenotypes. And now let's now open up another investigation line. We will sequence their genomes. We will look at all the methylation markers. We will do an epigenome-wide screening. We will look at their transcriptome. We will look at their proteome. We will look at their metabolome. So then you actually have hard outcomes of these diseases. And you say, well, for argument's sake, let's say you've got, you know, 5,000 cases with coronary artery disease and 5,000 controls which have emerged from this cohort. You can then say, okay, well, if we actually adopt a multi-omics approach to investigation of these diseases, where you're not just capturing the genetic variation, but you're capturing the downstream biological pathways. So you're not necessarily just looking at an association of one gene or just genetic variation in general, but you're actually looking at the consequences of that variation in terms of how that translates into downstream biological pathways. You can then begin to get an insight into the underlying causes of why 5,000 people may have wandered down and had heart attacks, and why the other 5,000 may have been protected from heart attacks. So this is a new field of medicine where you are actually looking at a multi-omics approach backed up with this large population sample with different exposures. And the bioinformatics in this day and age allows us to be able to bring these resources together, to be able to answer these fundamental questions, which actually would not even have been possible, 3-5 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of collecting the data properly, as someone who's gone through the process, I've done well-manned checks with Bupa and with Nuffield, and I would say this is probably the most comprehensive assessment I've ever had, and it was for free for the research. Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, like, you know, the questionnaire is really detailed. The nursing staff were fantastic. The fact, you know, you're taking bloods, I got my results, I got my assessment, I got my risk profile. There's so much stuff that I can do using that data in the present, but also the fact that I'm also contributing to this massive research project that could help save lives in the future and understand the disparities in the diseases. And it's not just about cardiometabolic problems, you know, it's a whole suite of different issues, as you've eloquently explained. It's amazing. It's an incredible project, and that's why I'm so passionate about it, and that's why I wanted to talk about it on the podcast today.
Yeah, so I think, you know, again, Rupi, when we put the construct of the study together, we were funded by the Wellcome Trust, an incredibly generous contribution in order to be able to get this study off the ground. We weren't funded to generate reports for patients. So we felt that there were, you know, if thousands of people, tens of thousands of people are going to participate, give up their 1 hour of time and give their kind of samples for analysis, there had to be something for them. It was an obligation at a clinical level to be able to give them ownership of their data, to allow them to make some assessment of their health and allow them to make improvements in their health where they're needed. So this was a kind of tag on, if you like, in terms of what we were doing to the main part of the study. And so we are now making every single piece of data that we have at hand available through the kind of report that you've seen to every participant. And that means that the person has access to, you know, the blood pressure levels, body fat, body composition, BMI, you know, waist hip ratios, ECGs, which are reported, lung function, retinal photography, cholesterol, blood pressure. And you're quite right. If you go and have these assessments with, commercial organizations like Bupa, you don't get that depth of report. It's just not there. And we're doing it free because, you know, we have an obligation to the people who come and participate in this research. So it's absolutely free of cost. And we're doing it free also because we've had community engagement. You talked about, you know, how this comes together. And I gave you the example of the freezers. Well, you know, we were about to embark on the study and COVID hits us. And we were planning to do the study at Imperial College, at London Northwest Hospitals and various other hospitals. And they became no-go territories because of COVID restrictions. So we had to move the research out into the community. So I approached the Singh Sabha Gurdwara in Southall and said, look, you've got this premises, it has the potential of being used for the service to humanity. And, you know, I tell you, it took Harmeet, who's the general secretary of the Gurdwara, and his committee members with Mr. Samra, no longer than a couple of meetings to decide that that's what they're going to do. So they leased out the building for 5 years to Imperial College at £100 rent per year. Okay. So that's a contribution of £1.5 million by the community to make a facility available onto the research program to make things happen. So to make things happen, it requires huge infrastructure. And similarly, we've had, you know, people saying, well, you know, okay, I'll contribute to this report and I'll put some money in there. And that's how it happened. So we're looking at getting engagement from, you know, every single person who's listening to this program who's of South Asian origin between the ages of 18 and 85. Just go onto the website, log in, come and spend a nice day with us, understand your health, and contribute to the health of future generations.
Absolutely. I had no idea that the report wasn't actually part of funding. That's incredible. And the sacrifice and the community element and what they've donated is amazing as well. I'm so glad we touched on that today because I wouldn't have had any idea about that. I know we've got a hard stop in about 5 minutes, so I want to be respectful of your time. I just want to ask you two, one thing is fairly big, so we can shorten that. And then another thing about just the future of what you imagine cardiology to look like when you're practicing in 5 or 10 years' time, or perhaps some of your colleagues. There is a growing recognition of a person's gut microbe having a role in the pathophysiology of disease, particularly metabolic risk. And, you know, we know there's a lot of research going on this. It's naive of us to think that you can do absolutely everything. You know, you've talked about retinal photography and bloods and genotyping, transcriptomics, etc. But do you think there is a role to collaborate with other organizations that could help you further understand the impact of other environmental triggers as well as the microbe in particular? And I'm thinking of, you know, research institutes like the Quadrum or APC in Cork or King's College, perhaps.
Indeed. So the South Asia Biobank is planning to collect stool samples eventually. Okay. Oh, so brilliant. We are going to be looking at the gut microbiome and to be able to put that as one of the approaches of trying to answer these diseases. It's a very, very interesting area. As you know, the initial work on the gut microbiome was done in rats, where you have obese rats, lean rats. You can take the microbiome from the lean rats, put it into the obese rats, and vice versa. And after a period of time, the obese rats become lean, the lean rats become obese, depending on their change of microbiome. And this work has been replicated at some level by Tim Spector and his colleagues, published a really nice paper in Nature Medicine a couple of years ago in their twin studies at King's College. And we feel that for the Asian community and its prevalence of obesity, this is going to be an important thing to pursue. We're not doing it just yet. So people listening in don't have to come in with a stool sample. So our initial strategy is just to collect blood and urine samples. But you're quite right. It's microbiome is a very important area to factor in. And this is one of the sub-studies that we'll be picking up in due course.
Brilliant. And just to close, you've been privy to a lot of this information about the risk profiles affecting South Asians. I'm very interested to know if you have any daily or weekly activities that you do on a personal level that protect you and promote cardiovascular health.
Yeah, so Rupi, we're all in this together. Yeah. So, you know, I do try to make time for my workouts in the morning. It's the only time I can do that. Get up in the morning and, walk across to our little gym at the back and do my stuff. And you're a lot leaner than I am at the moment. So you're doing probably more of it than I am. But actually, it's a really, really important thing. I think until such point in time as we are able to bridge this gap of knowledge and we have personalized medicine, either for the individual or for the population, it is paramount to be able to ensure that we deal with the risk factors optimally so that we can curb the burden of disease. So, good, healthy diet, crucial. Physical activity and maintaining optimal weight, crucial. Treating blood pressure, treating cholesterol, preventing diabetes, treating diabetes, crucial. Stopping smoking, crucial. Keeping alcohol intake down, crucial. Plenty of good, fresh intake of vegetables and fruits, crucial. So until such point in time as we find this kind of personalized medicine approach, the message, I guess, is get the basics right, deal with these important risk factors, because there are some studies which say if you deal with these important risk factors, you can drive risk down by 2/3 to 80% for the population. And so we will continue to pursue the reasons for the gap. And, we look forward to engagement from, people listening in today. But that should not prevent all of us to turn the screws on, move away from the thrust of just being healthy, but move away from being normal to actually optimally healthy. That's where it's at for Asians. If you've got a twofold excess risk of these diseases, you can't afford to be normal. Yeah, you can't afford to have normal blood pressure. I mean, normal blood pressure of 140/90 is two times the risk of 110/70. So get ourselves into the optimal range for these risk factors to help drive the risk down. So that's why that's kind of here and now approach as opposed to the futuristic approach.
Brilliant. Prof, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure to chat to you. I hope you've enjoyed your first podcast experience. And perhaps in the future, I can donate my microbial samples as well. When you start collecting those as part of the biobank, I'll be more than happy to come back.
Yeah, again. It won't be difficult. You could even post it to us.
Fab. That's great.
I really hope you enjoyed that podcast episode. Please do go check out sabiobank.org. All the links to everything that we chatted about today are on the podcast show notes at thedoctorskitchen.com. Make sure you sign up for the newsletter where I share something to eat, read, and listen to every single week to inspire you to live a healthier, happier life in mind and body. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and I will see you here next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.